Welcome to the Citizens for Health radio show on Building Fortunes Radio with your hosts Jim Turner and Peter Mingles. Make sure you check us out by clicking on the Citizens for Health radio show link on buildingfortunesradio.com. That's www.buildingfortunesradio.com. Citizens for Health provides over 100,000 supporters with consumer news, action alerts, and opportunities to take action. For nearly two decades, Citizens for Health has been a nonprofit pioneer in the natural health freedom movement. The Citizens for Health Education Foundation offers tools to inform the public of health issues and educate and influence policymakers. Jim Turner is here to spread the word about some of the most interesting topics that can affect your world, from the dangers of mislabeled or dangerous products to the questions and concerns of vaccines. You'll want to listen to Jim as he speaks on behalf of Citizens for Health. And now, on to our show with Jim Turner and Peter Mingles. Take it away, Peter.
Hello, everyone. Peter Mingles here. You're listening to us on Building Fortunes Radio. It's www.buildingfortunesradio.com. This is our super special segment with Jim Turner. Jim is an attorney with Citizens for Health. They've got a great website, citizens.org. For those people who need help on spelling, CITIZENS.ORG, citizens.org. Sign up for their newsletter. Jim has been an attorney with Citizens for Health since almost the super very beginning, back in 1993, if I recollect correctly. He was starting with them originally, though, even before then, wrote a book called Chemical Feast, was one of the original Ralph Nader Raiders, and I have a huge level of respect for Jim Turner's philosophy, knowledge, experience, all that other stuff. So, we skipped last week because I had some roofing guy that was supposed to come over and do a roofing repair, and I didn't want people banging in the process of doing that or me being interrupted. So we are here today live, and I promise to do as many of these live as we possibly can. But during this whole coronavirus thing, there's been a lot of changes happening in our world, and they've affected big things and they've affected small things. And Jim Turner is going to talk a little bit about what's going on in Washington, D.C., but just before we started our radio show, I was reminded one more time on how things have changed in even a small way. So as I was rubbing my eyeglasses with the cloth that's been approved for me to be able to rub my eyeglasses with, I wound up knocking off that little rubber thing that sits on your nose and that little guard thing, you know, kind of got two of them, one on your left nostril, one on your right nostril, that little rubber thing held in place by that little teeny-weeny screw. And usually I'd be able to go to the eyeglass places and meet the girls there and say, hey, can you do me a favor? This thing broke again. Could you fix this? They'd be sure, lickety-split, go have a seat. We'll be right back down. And I'd be in and out, and a little inconvenience, but it'd be over. And now I have to make an appointment and maybe wear a mask because they're not even open yet for the general public. How in the world am I going to deal? These are the small, seemingly insignificant, but realistic things that happen as a result of coronavirus. So I'm going to kick off with one of those teeny-weeny little things that may have changed, and I'll let Jim Turner kick off the rest of it on some of the bigger issues that may have changed. So, Jim Turner, thanks for being here.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Peter, and I just thought it might be interesting to report a little bit from Washington. It's been in the news quite a bit. Things have, of course, calmed down now, but a week to 10 days ago was very, very intense here, and some interesting experiences. Our office, we've been going into our office once a week to pick up mail and anything that we need from the office, stop with various errands, you know, go to the bank and go to the FedEx and so forth. And we were down there and driving back from Washington. We drive right up 16th Street, which is the street that goes from the White House all the way to the district line. And it's the longest street at the center of Washington. It's kind of the backbone of Washington, 16th Street. It was going to be, when L'Enfant planned the city, it was going to be the Avenue of the Presidents. And it was going to be 16 lanes wide. And it was a very spectacular imagination that he had. Now it's just about four or five lanes wide, and it's still a very impressive street. Lots of embassy-type buildings on it and so forth. But what was interesting that I thought the public outside of Washington might be interested to know is that from the White House all the way to the district line, which is, I think, about 2 miles, 2.5, 3 miles, something like that, it was solidly lined on both sides of the streets, so both sides of the street. with people who were demonstrating in support of Black Lives Matter and creating a safer, sounder place all the way. And, you know, maybe one or two people deep with signs and, you know, just there. And they must have been there for a long time. And I thought that was very interesting to see because it meant that what I was seeing on TV, I didn't see any of this on TV. What I had seen on TV was a very small slice of what was actually going on. So I thought it would be interesting for people to know that part of things. As far as the city's going, we're starting to open up gradually. The restaurants now have the right to serve in their patios, and the city is taking a lane away from each one of the roads and letting restaurants on those roads set up like sidewalk cafe type serving. We're still with the masks outdoors, and you have to have your 6 feet of separation, and you're supposed to do everything you can to minimize circulating for the virus. But they are working on getting the restaurants, beauty salons, and so forth opened. And I think the mayor is going for a full opening this month, and we'll see what's happening. Around the country where people are opening up again, they're now starting to get a little bit of expansion of the COVID-19. So you want to be very careful about that sort of thing. So, Peter, that was part of my thoughts of something might be useful from the district here to know what's going on. It's pretty intense. I did drive right by where Black Lives Matter is painted on the road. That's actually it's right next door to where my original office in Washington was. And that's an iconic corner in Washington, D.C. It's that church that was involved. It's called the Church of the Presidents, and been a kind of a mainstay in White House life for well over 100 years, maybe closer to 150 years. But okay, so that's my report from here. And if you got any questions or thoughts, and you want to open up some other topic.
So your note about the protesters or whatever it might be was that the whole street wasn't packed. It was just a couple of lines of people, one or two deep, as opposed to like the whole entire city street thinking with a million people, like as if it was a presidential inauguration or rock concert.
Well, the way it was is they had very, very intense crowds down near the White House.
Mm-hmm.
What was impressive to me was that they had these lines, one or two deep, all the way up the street with people and all kinds of people, not, you know, these weren't, you would not look at this group of people and think that they were protesting anything. I mean, they look like, you know, very calm, normal, accepting American people who, you know, kind of support what's going on in general. And they were out on the street, and there were a lot of them. If they had been masked the way a demonstration goes, they would have looked pretty impressive. In fact, just a few days ago, they had a very, very impressive demonstration right there at that historic corner when a whole bunch of churches got together, including the oldest church in Arlington, Virginia. I think it's the oldest church, but it was a very old church, very iconic church. Led all these congregations from churches and filled in that street. They were distancing even when they did it, but they moved in unison and they did their prayers and were a very unique kind of demonstration. And it was pretty densely packed, even though they were spacing people for COVID-19 purposes. It was still, the street was very packed. So there have been both packed streets and then this long line of people from the White House, just a little north of the White House, north of Lafayette Park, all the way to the top of the district line. So that's driving up through it. I was just driving home, and it was a pretty impressive amount of energy sent our way as people driving.
Wow. So in reference to your experience, give us the reason for why there would be protests, the positive reason in this whole democratic process, why protests are necessary. And then maybe you can also give us some of the philosophies or observations on when they turn into violent protests, which will actually become looting and rioting. Because I can understand the protest part, but I don't really understand the benefit of the rioting part. So maybe you might be able to shed some light on that.
Okay. Well, first of all, I don't know that. I wouldn't necessarily argue the necessary argument. I can say why it happens and why a lot of people feel that they need to be out in the street and make this kind of a presentation. In my view, it should be possible to make the changes that need to be made because they're the right thing to do, and we don't need to be bludgeoned to do them. But they really need to be out in the street, apparently, in order to get somebody's attention. I've been watching this for years. Even in the 60s, I went around Washington on several different marches. I was living here, and people would come to town, and some would stay at our house, and they would down to protest. And I can remember going down and going around from building to building and finding, like at the some of the campus buildings on George Washington's campus, which is right in the center of D.C., there were a bunch of beat-up kids bleeding in the lobbies and so forth, and it was pretty tough. And then I did get out to the Pentagon and observe that, and lots of beating up of kids there. It's pretty tough when these organizations confront that kind of power. Today, we had very much less violence in the demonstrations. I don't think we had very much at all in D.C., although I will say that lots of the D.C. Stores downtown were boarded up. When the Martin Luther King riots occurred, I happened to be in Washington at that point as well. I was just getting ready to come down for the summer. And the neighborhoods where the black community lived at that point just swelled up and poured out and went down several of the main thoroughfares and destroyed everything they could get their hands on. Once again, nothing like that happened here this time. In fact, when I read about what's been going on across the country, it sounds like it's been surprisingly calm. I've been reading police chiefs and other authorities saying that they had predicted much more violence than they've been getting. So that's an interesting thing to think about. Your question was, is it necessary? And what are they after? What's trying to happen? Or what are the people who are raising these questions raising? And I can remember when I was in law school, I was in law school at Ohio State, and one of the things that we did is every law student got to spend one night on a policeman shift. So, you know, they pick us up in a police car at 6 o'clock in the afternoon or the evening, and we would ride with them until 6 in the morning and see what goes on. And it was fascinating because, for example, we got a call in this car about a domestic violence event going on. And my guy drove right to the house, as did a total of 11 policemen showing up, policemen, and I think there were two policewomen at that point. Showed up at this house where the man and wife or man and woman were having this horrible fight. And I was a law student, and I'm sitting there saying, gee, this seems like a strange way to respond. Maybe a social worker would be better, or a marriage counselor. Maybe a cop could show up with a marriage counselor. And they were trying in every way they could to disarm the situation. And I don't know that they had any particular training for it. But I noticed in the demands that are being made that are called defund the police, if you read down into them, you find that things they're asking for are, for example, and these things are starting to happen, interestingly enough, For example, the very thing that I had the experience with, they're saying, why shouldn't we have the marriage counseling function moved out of the police department into somewhere else? And that's an interesting question. There are other functions that the police perform that there might be professionals that could actually do it better. That's the one I think is the most illustrative. One of the other big things that's happening is that I suspect most people don't realize that the Defense Department has a program where they take surveyed, that's, you know, worn out, you know, old military equipment, and your police department can get it. They have to just ask for it, and they can move the military equipment into the police departments locally. And one of the demands being made by the protesters is that those kinds of programs be stopped, that we don't need to have Army-class military weapons in a civilian police district. So it's another thing that's coming along. What's happening, from what I can see, where anything's happening, is that money that's been going to build up the enforcement tools of the police is being challenged. And by the way, there are police officers and police chiefs who are on that side of things saying, we don't actually need to have bazookas and anti-tank stuff and armored cars and so on. We don't need those things. So I'm watching that with some interest to see how it unfolds. And I believe that that's the kind of thing that the protesters or resistors or whatever one calls them are trying to call attention to. And again, underscore that here, certainly in Washington, we've had virtually no violence. And my impression from reading the papers is that that's pretty common across the country right now, that these have been a notably peaceful demonstrations. So I don't know that they're necessary, but I know that there are people who believe that they need to be in the street in order to make this happen. And I think that to the extent that they're making a statement on behalf of the community, it's a good thing for the community to tell the police and the mayor and people like that what they feel about the police being in their neighborhood.
Well, the interesting thing is I'm reading some of the headlines, and they're telling a slightly different story as far as the violence is concerned relative to the looting and things like that, even in predominantly safe neighborhoods. And I'm reading about looting in different countries relating to Black Lives Matter, breaking into people's stores. We hear about the one guy that was shot who was asleep at the Wendy's drive-thru, who resisted arrest and then he was shot. They burnt down the Wendy's restaurant. So I'm really not sure of any of the positive impact of why
I'd like to see what you've got there, but I know I've been reading over and over from police chiefs and even Barr saying that the violence was far, far below what they had expected. That's one of those fact questions. We can all open our eyes and look and see, and I'll watch for more, and you watch for more and see what we can come up with.
Right, exactly. Okay, so that's in relationship to this sort of stuff and relative to some of the other things that might be going on. Tell us a little bit about the regular world as far as your world on the – I think you said something about the homeopathy bill moving forward.
Well, yeah, the homeopathy petition, Americans for Homeopathy Choice, filed its petition 2 weeks ago asking for clear – rules about homeopathy that would recognize it as safe and effective, that it does not qualify for new drug regulation, that they were basically on the market long before 1962 when the new drug law was passed, and that they comply with all the safety and efficacy requirements for an over-the-counter drug, for example, and they are effective and people want them. So that was what was put in, and we put into the petition, and it's going to the FDA, and we will now hear something back from them. We have to, they're required to respond in some way in 6 months. Usually they, when these petitions come in, they say, well, we've been really busy since you filed your petition. We haven't had a chance to get to it, but we'll take another 6 months and maybe we'll get to it. And then generally speaking, when that 6 months is over, you don't hear from them, and then 10 years later, it's still sitting there. That's kind of the way they've been operating their petition process. We have the impression that maybe they'll be a little more responsive to the homeopathic situation, because there's been an enormous amount of pressure and interest from the public about homeopathic drugs. And so that particular forum is one we'll want to keep your audience informed of. And then they can also send in comments. You can go to the Americans for Homeopathy Choice page, and they will show you. You can click on various, guide you through what to click on, and you can make a comment to the FDA saying that you think homeopathy is important and homeopathy drugs are important to you and your family, if that's correct, and you would like to see them regulated. And if you wanted to go so far as to say you like this regulation, that we would like that. On the other hand, you can go read the regulation and decide if there are things in it you don't like, you can file that too. We want to basically get the FDA to understand that there are actual people who are buying homeopathic products and will be severely bereft if the FDA policy currently being proposed goes into effect. And that policy is basically to treat homeopathic drugs as if they're new drugs, just like pharmaceuticals, and then they would have to go through various kinds of testing. And one witness for the Federal Trade Commission, it was a hearing on dietary supplements, and said that it would take $100 million to get one active ingredient to become a drug. That's not going to happen with any homeopathic drug. Just not going to happen, because homeopathic drugs don't have profit margins that allopathic drugs do. And so you will never generate $100 million to get one active ingredient recognized by FDA. The way it's going to have to be done is through the homeopathic pharmacopoeia, which is recognized in the food and drug law. And it's built around the premise that if you create the homeopathic drugs properly, legally, you will not have harm and you'll get benefits. People will feel better, diseases will be cured, all kinds of things will happen. But it has to be done in an intelligent manner and non-misleading manner. One of the main things in the proposed regulation is to make sure that products that are not homeopathic don't get to use the word homeopathic. And there are a bunch of those out there doing that now, and we're hoping that those will get cleaned up by this process. But that homeopathic issue is developing, and it probably will get much, much hotter before we can relax about it. There's lots of resistance from the drug industry about homeopathic drugs, for example. They're completely different industries. And there will be some, to the extent that the pharmaceutical industry products are being superseded by homeopathy, there will be serious repercussions. So that's
okay.
My homeopathy story.
Perfect. So we have everybody kind of considers it a relatively safe product. It takes about 10 years for them to finally figure out whether they're going to consider it a drug or nutritional supplement or whatever the hell they're going to figure out and how they're going to regulate it. And then we're going to have a vaccine for coronavirus in 2 weeks or whatever the thing might be.
Oh, I thought we already had it. I'll be darned.
Yeah.
I'm going to just wave a tiny little flag here and say it's going to be a hard, long road to come up with a coronavirus vaccine. As far as I can tell, they're having one heck of a time figuring out how to deal with this thing. I noticed that Dr. Fauci said maybe we'll need 5 or 6 vaccines, said that about a week ago. I noticed that the thing is supposedly mutates every 7 days. Does that mean we need a new vaccine every 7 days? Our argument from Citizens for Health is that whatever else is done, you know, distancing, masks, testing, and so forth, there should be a real attention paid to helping people adopt lifestyle activities that help strengthen their immune system, strengthen their own ability to resist the coronavirus or whatever else is coming. And also, it's very important to understand this is the beginning and not the end of the infectious disease problems. There were four of these outbreaks during the last administration of Obama. None of them got out of hand. They were all managed. When people showed up in Texas with Ebola, they were immediately hospitalized and kept there. I think we had maybe two deaths total, and they kept it under control. MRSA, same thing. H1N1, they were able to keep it contained more or less. I'm pretty sure it's going to be a long time before we have an actual working corona vaccine because of all, you know, the things I've mentioned and some others. I mean, it's a very, very unique virus, not like anything we've ever seen.
Right. From the things that I've read, Moderna, which is a company that Fauci is somewhat tied to one way or another, they're already doing or been approved for doing live testing on 3,000 people, I think the number was. And Johnson & Johnson's already got a permission to do testing on 1,000 people. And I'm sure there's a line of people lined up longer than that one you saw on 16th Street. Just can't wait to roll up their sleeves and get vaccinated by these safe and effective vaccines that are going to be able to help solve this problem. I don't know how this is all going to happen. And it's crazy. There's it's going to be crazy. So I'd like you to kind of discuss how do vaccines that are so questionable rush through this whole process where the FDA has taken 10 years to get through the stuff with homeopathy, which is probably if you drank five bottles of homeopathic anything, you probably might get full and a little bit of an upset stomach, but you're probably not going to die.
Right. And what I would say is a Citizens for Health physician is a vaccine choice. If people want to be vaccinated, that's fine. And if they don't want to, that's fine. If it's necessary, because they can demonstrate that they've got a vaccine that is safe and effective and it will not cause more side effects than it does help, and that they can demonstrate that it's necessary. If you get volunteers taking vaccines and you get a 95% herd immunity, and it might even be as low as 60% by some numbers, but certainly 95%, it's considered to be herd immunity and you don't need to vaccinate the other 5%. If we could have a situation in which people who wanted the vaccine, got the vaccine, and that created the community support under the vaccine thinking, that we would not oppose that in any way. Conversely, we are very strongly opposed to any mandated vaccines except in extremis. And we are not in extremis at this point. We believe that trying to foment or trying to create a mandatory corona 19 vaccine, would be very, very dangerous. First of all, it's apparent that people do get coronavirus infections that don't manifest, and then they go around the community and spread the disease. And you want to be really, really careful about giving somebody a vaccine and telling the world that they're safe, and then they actually turn out being vaccine spreaders, virus spreaders. That's just one example of the kind of problem that you can have in a situation that we're very, very unclear about. A second problem is that we are not at all sure what this thing is. And when I say it's going to be tough to make a vaccine, I'm reasonably sure you'll hear that Johnson & Johnson or somebody else has come up and they've got something they call a vaccine. But I would advise everybody to read really carefully what it says. For example, the flu vaccine that was used up until now is less than 50% effective, according to the CDC. And there's also stuff being suggested that if you did get the flu vaccine previously, you may be more susceptible to the COVID virus. Now, again, I don't know the answer to that, but I don't know that anybody knows. And if there are some people who seem to be having that kind of reaction, we want to be very, very careful about mandating what should be done. And so I would say it's very unlikely there'll be a vaccine very soon. And if there is a vaccine, you'll have to really be very, very alert to learning how it works and what it's meant for. In particular, recognize that it could be a tool to create an apparent immunity, which actually helps spread the disease. These are the kind of things that we should be very, very seriously looking into. And not only because they're here and we're dealing with them, but this is very early in the viral attack story. There are going to be more and more of these things. There are probably going to be more and more virulence, and we are going to have to think through how we're going to respond. We would argue from Citizens for Health that building your own health is the best way to deal with these epidemic, pandemic events. And then, of course, if people want to take a vaccine after they studied it, we support their right to do that.
So if you can, you've educated us a little bit earlier about some of the words like there's no evidence or, you know, those types of things. And usually when you hear people say, you know, there's no evidence, that that's somewhat of a real alarm getter. Your ears should probably perk up. Part of my problem with this is when they say things like, well, the data shows, and people are making decisions based on the data that they're given. And I hate to sound skeptical, but I'm very questionable or always questioning the data, because the data can be manipulated and probably often is to serve whoever wants to have the data. So when people start off their statements by saying, well, the data shows this or the data shows this, I always have to first ask the question, where is your reference to the data and how accurate is that data to be able to make this educated argument? Because I think we're really in a situation where we don't know who to trust or who to form any kind of opinion on based on whatever data. So when they do their 3,000-person study or their 1,000-person study, I don't know how many people are going to be eliminated from their study because it just doesn't fit the data that they need. So I'll let you comment on that if you want.
Well, I don't think we need to go to the chicanery side of things. I mean, first of all, the tools they're using are very similar to the tools that told us that Hillary Clinton was going to win the 2016 presidential election. The biggest problem we have is that we don't have a very good testing system, so we don't actually know what's going on. We're kind of blinded, and we don't really understand what's actually happening. And so you see these very the first thing I say about the Corona-19 situation is we don't know much about it at all. We're really wandering around in the dark. The second point is I think we have a math problem, because if you look at how many people get the disease and then how many of the people who get the disease actually get sick from the disease, there's a pretty big disparity. There's a lot of people who have the virus and aren't sick. And then there are a lot of people who get sick but not really sick. And then there are some people who die. And so there's something very odd going on here, because it's very virulent for certain people. In that kind of a situation, my inclination and our Citizens of Health inclination would be to try to figure out what are the vulnerable groups? Who are the people that are most vulnerable? I mean, if you're in a nursing home, you're really on the edge of problems. If you're that's a nursing home is that way. If you have a high blood pressure, 75% of all the people who've died from coronavirus have had high blood pressure. So all in all, it's a pretty It's a pretty daunting picture to know what you should do. I mean, I kind of follow the rules that they're laying out, work from home and keep things going that we can, try to help people that we can help, and keep our heads down, because we do not know what this thing is or what it's going to do next, and we don't know what's coming after it. In the infectious disease world, this is just one event. As I said, within the last 10 years, we've had four other events that brought very, very dangerous viruses into the American space, and we were able to handle them more effectively. It might well be that the next one we're going to have more trouble handling.
Very interesting points. So guess what? We're running out of time. So for those people that are listening in, you want to check out citizens.org, CITIZENS.org. Sign up for the newsletter. Get the action alerts. Jim does a great job. Listen to the previous radio shows. You'll hear his perspectives on a whole bunch of things, plus the history on the way things work. And we love having Jim here to give us the insights and the personal examples of what's happening with this world. And then moving forward, Jim, is there anything else you want to close out with?
No, I think we're fine. It's not an easy subject to talk about because the information is so sketchy and contradictory and so on. So, not as clear. There's not such clear direction. I mean, you got to kind of watch yourself and help your friends and neighbors and try to contribute in a way that makes the community more comfortable. And other than that, we're sitting and waiting to see what happens. If there's an uptick. If 17 states now are back up to higher seven-day averages than they've ever had, that's very, very problematic. And then, of course, as you say, we can't even really rely on the data in large part because we haven't been very good collecting it. So we don't know really what's going on. But that's all I have to say for today. But maybe next week we can delve into a little more and see if we know more about what's happening.
It'd be interesting to see how this accelerates the closer we get to a presidential election, if you know what I mean. I suspect that we think they're going to become a little bit hotter, move a little bit faster, and a little bit more intensely the closer to November we get. But we shall see. Thanks for listening in. For those people listening in, you just heard Jim Turner. He's a great attorney over at Citizens for Health. Citizens for Health. Go to citizens.org, sign up for the newsletter. And Jim, thanks for spending the time that you spend with us.
Thanks
for keeping us.
I appreciate it, and I look forward to talking next week. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the Citizens for Health radio show, brought to you by Citizens for Health on buildingfortunesradio.com with Jim Turner and Peter Mingles. Thanks for listening. For nearly two decades, Citizens for Health has been a nonprofit pioneer in the natural health freedom movement. Go to www.citizens.org to learn more and always listen in to Building Fortunes Radio, where our special host, Jim Turner, shares crucial information about many of the most important issues that affect your world. Citizens for Health provides over 100,000 supporters with consumer news, action alerts, and opportunities to take action. So listen in, get involved, and help spread the word. Be sure to check out the buildingfortunesradio.com website to hear more Citizens for Health segments with Jim Turner and Peter Mingle. And read about what's new on www.citizens.org. It's been our privilege to have you listen in. Jim Turner, Peter, and I want to say thanks for listening and ask you to go spread the word, tell a friend, join our newsletter, and go make a difference in your world.